You're listening to The Sweeper, the pan-European football podcast that brings you all the news from the 55 UEFA nations and sometimes a little bit beyond.
On this episode of The Sweeper, we talk about our experience at the Madeiran Derby between Marítimo and Nacional, Cape Verde's scintillating AFCON campaign, and the southernmost football match on the planet. Hello and welcome to another episode of The Sweeper, the global football podcast co-hosted by myself, Lee Wingate, and Paul Watson. Paul, you're in the UK. I'm currently in Madeira. This is the first episode we've ever recorded remotely from the same time zone and the first time I've ever been able to see the ocean while podcasting. And it is a wonderful view.
I'm supposed to pretend I'm not jealous, aren't I think at this point. But I have to say, looking at the photos you've posted and just even the brightness in your face right now, I am incredibly jealous. It looks absolutely lovely.
I got a little bit sunburnt the other day. My pale British skin sort of wilted in the 20 degree temperatures we have here at the moment.
Oh, it looks like a fantastic place to go for a sort of a short break and to watch some football. And yeah, I'm excited to hear all about your adventures in Madeira.
It's been really good. It is pretty much a place where retired British and German couples come to go on holiday. But apart from that, it is an incredibly beautiful place. And yeah, I went to the derby between Marítimo and Nacional. That was a really good game. But first of all, my little mission while I was here was to try and find out why the island clubs are not doing so well at the moment. So we wrote on Twitter in around May last year that for the first time since the 1985 season in Portugal, there would be no island clubs in the Primeira Liga. And I think one of the things that made me so curious to come here was to sort of find out why that is, because there was obviously a chance it could be a pure coincidence, but perhaps I thought maybe it's getting harder for them to compete. Perhaps it's harder for them to sort of attract players. Perhaps the logistical difficulties are getting greater and greater. So I spoke to a really helpful fan. His name is David Pedro Costa before the game yesterday. So a big thanks to him. And he basically explained to me that for this entire 38-year period that there have been island clubs in the Primeira Liga, Marítimo were there the entire time. So they were basically the constant, and the other clubs, so you have their opponents in the derby yesterday, Nacional. There's another Madeiran club called Unial, who were dissolved actually a few years ago. And there was also Santa Clara, of course, in the Azores. All of those are kind of yo-yo clubs. But Marítimo have been the constant. So he said, your question is not why are the island clubs suffering, but why did Marítimo get relegated?
That's very interesting to hear. Was there sort of a reason why Marítimo are struggling? I mean, could it even be linked to the fact that, by your account, nobody's under about 65 in the island? Does that limit their ability to grow young players?
I don't think so, because they actually had a pretty good team out there yesterday. I think it seems to me mismanagement is the answer to the question. I thought it could be money, but David explained to me that the Madeiran government gives clubs in the top flight of Portuguese football 1.7 million euro per season. And that sort of helps them with anything from administrative costs to travel, the logistics of playing, I think, was it 19 or 17 games on the mainland per season. So it doesn't seem like money was the problem, because if you sort of list the budgets of the clubs in Portugal's Primeira Liga, Marítimo would have had like a mid-range budget, really. He explained that there was a change of president a couple of years back, and a guy who had been in charge overseeing a period of real stability, Carlos Pereira, left and was replaced by a pretty inexperienced guy called Rui Fontes. He's no longer president. It was a very short reign, and he was ousted in November last year. But under his time in charge, a lot of players were signed on very high salaries that barely played. They went through three coaches last season, and I think it just ended up being sort of one of those seasons, I guess. Every sort of mid-range club has one of those from time to time, and that's what led them to go down.
From my limited understanding of it, they're in the promotion shake-up this year. In fact, aren't both the two size for Madeira in the sort of upper echelons of the second division at the moment.
Yeah, so all three of the island clubs are sort of bouncing back immediately. So you have Santa Clara in second place, Nacional, who were the away team, in third place on 34 points. And they went into the game against Marítimo 6 points ahead. Marítimo were in fourth place on 28 points. And I keep switching between Marítimo and Marítimo because Marítimo is sort of the Brazilian pronunciation, which is the very limited knowledge of Portuguese I have is Brazilian Portuguese. But I kept getting corrected yesterday to say Marítimo. So if you're wondering how it's really pronounced in Portugal, it is Marítimo. The game itself was really, really good. I mean, it was very unusual to watch a game in January in temperatures of 20 degrees. I have to say that was a nice and sort of welcome addition. I'm used to watching Austrian football in February in temperatures around the freezing mark. And the stadium is lovely. It's down by the coast and you've got all the hillside of Funchal, the capital of Madeira, in the background, sort of overhanging the stadium. So a wonderful view. And I made a couple of observations pre-kickoff. So the first observation is that they don't get foreign journalists. I asked the security guy at the door where I was told to go, is this the place for accreditations? And he just sort of pointed me down a corridor. So I went walking down this corridor and then I saw press room. So I thought, oh, that sounds promising. I'll go in there. And I went into the press room and I don't think it was supposed to be in use because there was a big hole in the ceiling. Do you remember that story we talked about where the raccoon fell through the ceiling?
Yeah, was he there?
He wasn't there, but it looked like a raccoon-sized hole. It reminded me of that story from the MLS. And there were just a load of cuddly toys in a big, big box. So, you know, sometimes you see the fans, yes, they throw on cuddly toys. I wondered if it was just a collection of those. But certainly there was no one in the press room. So I thought, well, this isn't the place where I'm supposed to be. So I kept walking further along the corridor until a policeman said, how did you get here? And I explained that I was a member of the press and that I had accreditation. And he got the security manager who said, you have to go up to the third floor. So I got in the lift and went up to the third floor, got out of the lift. And some guy said, what are you doing here?
It feels like this could go on forever. It's like a version of hell.
I'm not at the end, mate. I'm not at the end. So he said, I showed him the pass I had on my phone. He said, that's not what you need. You need to go back outside to the ticket office and pick up your accreditation there. So got the lift back down, went outside the stadium, went to the ticket office, went up to the woman who did speak English. And she said, no, what you've got on your phone is fine. You should just be able to go in with that. So I was back at square one. The guy just let me through and just said, go straight to the pitch. And I got straight to the pitch and somebody come down and said, you can't be here. And I was like, I don't want to be here. I just want to get to the media stand. So after all of this, they sent me up to the media stand. And about 20 minutes after I first entered the ground, I took my place and sat there while they played Tina Turner songs. The Madeirans absolutely love a bit of Tina. That's what I learned yesterday.
That's amazing. God, you have to hope they don't get into the Champions League or anything anytime soon, because you can imagine like 150 international press turning up, all getting sent through these corridors, back to the ticket office, onto the pitch. It's crazy.
But the game itself was super interesting because Nacional began so strongly, the away team. And I was thinking, well, this is going to be, you know, very one-sided if it continues like that. They had Marítimo sort of pinned back into their own half and Marítimo were just limited to counter-attacks. So Nacional hit the bar at one point and I thought the first goal is only a matter of time. And then at the other end, a player called Bruno Jadas picked up the ball about 35 yards out and hit this absolutely stunning curling effort into the top corner of the goal. It was one of the greatest goals I've ever seen live. Absolutely brilliant stuff. And then again, 10 minutes later, he blasted the ball into the top corner. It was a sort of, the second goal reminded me, do you remember South Africa's opening goal at the 2010 World Cup? Shabalala.
Yep, never forget that goal. Yeah.
It was pretty much like that, from that position, left-footed right into the top corner. At this point, I was like Googling this guy. Who's Bruno Jadas? Why have I never heard of him? It was 2-0 at the break. And then in the second half, it got a little bit interesting. because Nacional pulled a goal back. And they basically pulled a goal back because of the pitch. So it was a real nothing shot, like a low drive from Carlos Daniel. The goalkeeper dived across to get it. He had it completely covered, but it hit like a bobble right in front of him and then went over him.
Wow, you don't see that in a sort of proper professional game very often.
The pitch wasn't really in the best condition, I have to say. So it benefited Nacional at that point. And then they looked like they were really coming back into the game and that, you know, there might be an equalizer on the cards. They actually had a shot cleared off the line. And then in the 95th minute, Maritimo went all the way down the other end, countered a really devastating counter, and Bernardo Gomes made it 3-1. And that was pretty much that.
What's the atmosphere like at a game like this? Is it a nasty derby? Is there a sense of tension in the air, or is it a bit more... doesn't sound very Madeiran to have like a really nasty side to it.
No, it wasn't nasty at all. It was all quite convivial. When the Nacional fans arrived at the stadium, they sort of arrived in a bit of a convoy. They were all chanting and the Maritimo fans just sort of stopped to watch them. And yeah, there was no sort of shouting or anything like that. The fan base situation is actually really interesting in Madeira because since I've been here on Thursday, all I've seen around town is Maritimo fans, so wearing the green and red shirts. And I haven't actually come across any Nacional fans apart from the ones I saw at the stadium yesterday. So I asked David, what is sort of the breakdown here in terms of the amount of fans that support Maritimo and the amount that support Nacional? And he said, if I had to guess, it would be sort of 75% to 25%, which is obviously quite a significant difference. And one reason for that, I think, is the location of the stadiums. So I mentioned that the Maritimo Stadium is down by the coast. You can get there very easily from Funchal. It's a sort of a 20-minute walk, whereas the Nacional Stadium is right up in the hills. And one thing I have to tell you about Funchal is that it's incredibly hilly and steep. So you'll get a really good workout whenever you go anywhere. But the fact that this stadium is so far up in the hills, and actually it's about a 2-hour walk if you wanted to walk from the coastline, I think that probably has an impact. Because if you're a tourist coming to Madeira and you want to go to some football, if you're a local looking to get into football, or if you're a family with kids, you're going to take them to the Maritimo Stadium. And that, of course, means that, you know, as time goes on, they sort of get more fans supporting them. And I mean, in addition to that, there's obviously the fact that they are probably the most successful club in Madeira. They've, you know, got to cup finals, league cup finals. They've been in the top flight more than any of the other clubs here. But I definitely think that the location of the stadium plays a role.
I was wondering about their name, the fact they're called Nacional. Is there any political aspect? Is there like a pro-Portuguese and a like pro-independence aspect here, or is that just a name, like the fact they're called Nacional?
I think that's quite a common name for football clubs. You have a Nacional in Uruguay and in a lot of, I think, Spanish-speaking countries as well. The other thing that I found out about the fans, which I thought was super interesting, I was keen to find out if they take away fans to the mainland. And the answer is basically no, not really, because if you're an away fan that travels to the Portuguese mainland, you would need to be doing that sort of every 2 weeks. It's not really feasible to be going away for the whole weekend every 2 weeks. But what they do have is they have quite a few Madeirans based on the mainland who have gone there for, you know, in search of better opportunities, jobs, for many different reasons. And so quite a lot of the Madeiran people that are based on the mainland tend to go to Maritimo away games, but don't come to the home games. So that's sort of where all of their away fans come from.
That's funny, isn't it? To almost have two separate fan bases. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, but that is really interesting. One thing I was going to ask you is, so everyone, I think probably everyone knows Cristiano Ronaldo, of course, is from Madeira. So which of the two clubs was he at? Because he must have come through one of those two clubs.
Yeah, he, I think, went through the Nacional Academy at some point. And so they've named the training base after him. And I can, you know, say with great confidence that they're very proud of him here. So you have the Cristiano Ronaldo International Airport with that busk
The one that looks like Mick McCarthy, or used to.
Yeah, used to before. They have a Cristiano Ronaldo museum down on the coast, which I'm going to go to at some point this week. And then it was quite funny. The other day, I got the cable car up the hill. And as I came down, I just saw a little boy in a Ronaldo shirt doing the, you know, the Sioux celebration. Yeah, safe to say his influence is pretty much everywhere.
I imagine they do make a big deal of it. Because, yeah, I mean, it sounds like being in this sort of small island, you know, away from Portugal, there must be a limit to the number of sort of great players they've produced over the years, I'd imagine.
Yeah, Ronaldo is everything. I don't really know of too many other famous Madeiran footballers. I'm sure there are. But yeah, Ronaldo came to, I think his first club was Andorinha, then Nacional, and then after that he went to Sporting. So I will go to the Ronaldo Museum, and then I'll be able to tell everybody about that on the special Patreon episode that we're going to make about this Madeira trip. So I think we'll finish our mini Madeira segment there. But if you want to hear more about the football and my travel experiences on the island, we're happy to tell you that we will be making a special bonus podcast all about the trip exclusively for our Patreon community. So if you want to find out more about Madeira, more about the Cristiano Ronaldo Museum and all the fun tourist activities we got up to, now is the time to sign up to our Patreon at patreon.com/sweeperpod. That episode will be out on Monday, the 29th of January, and will also be accompanied by a patron-only blog post too. So do join us, patreon.com/sweeperpod, to get access to all that bonus content. Time for us to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk about the wonderful world of AFCON. Welcome back to part two of the Sweeper podcast, where we dedicate some time to talking about the Africa Cup of Nations, which is currently taking place in the Ivory Coast. We're going to talk in this segment about Cape Verde, Tanzania, and Gambia. Where do you want to start, Paul?
I think I want to start with Cape Verde, because what an amazing start to AFCON they've had.
Yeah, so two wins from two games, especially that first game against Ghana. I think a lot of people might have expected them to beat Mozambique in the second game, which they did 3-0. But that 2-1 win against Ghana was quite special.
It really was, wasn't it? And I know that Ghana have not been looking particularly convincing. I think it's been a hard start for Chris Hughton. I think he's struggling to maybe make his mark on the squad. A lot of people have, you know, been saying how Ghana have really struggled to look like the kind of side they should be with the players they've got in there. But even with all that put aside, and also with the fact that, you know, Cape Verde are not new to us, they have been excelling or, you know, punching above their weight for some years, it's still, even with all that put aside, an amazing result to have beaten Ghana in that first game. And the way they played, it was just sensational. So yeah, really exciting that the smallest nation by population in AFCON are, you know, pushing forward and into the knockout stages again.
I think we have to mention the winning goal in that Ghana game, because it was an absolute defensive calamity, wasn't it? There was a ball over the top. It went through the legs of Salisu. The goalkeeper came charging out and missed it. And it was a simple tap in for Gary Rodriguez. It was just about as bad a goal as you concede, really.
Yeah, but this for me is AFCON. It's AFCON absolutely summarized, that you get goals like that, and then you also get some of the most incredible football being played. So a good example, in a way, is the free kick that Bebe scored against Mozambique. It's fully 40 yards out. Absolute belter of a free kick. So I think it's this thing that AFCON just has the best, the worst, the mayhem. Why it's one of my favourite tournaments, and always has been, is this counterpoints between, yeah, this is kind of chaotic play, and suddenly this is beautiful play, and it all just rolls into this one amazing unpredictable package. So yeah, I think Ghana will be as embarrassed by that goal as Cape Verde would have been delighted to score it, that's for sure. But what I will also say, yeah, this free kick that Bebe scores next game was amazing, absolutely belter. And what cracked me up was the response to the media. Did you see quite a lot of the way it was reported?
No, I didn't.
Well, this tells you a lot about the clickbait society we live in. It's largely reported as former Manchester United forward or former Manchester United youngster Bebe scores long-range goal. And I had to look this up, because I did not remember him playing for Manchester United at all. And it turns out He was there for 4 years, 2010 to 2014, and he made a total of 2 appearances during that time. He was on loan to Beşiktaş, Rio Ave and Patros de Ferreira. So I think it's really telling that he's listed as an ex-Manchester United player when actually he's had this enormous career, played for loads of other clubs, and Manchester United is an absolute asterisk in that. And yet that's how they report it for the clicks, right?
Yeah, I think he was regarded as a bit of a flop at Manchester United. It was a rare Sir Alex Ferguson mistake, I think, is sort of the way that it was seen. But obviously he has gone on to have this amazing career afterwards. And that goal yesterday was amazing. I saw that he was actually a Portugal under-21 international and then must have switched his allegiance to Cape Verde. But as you say, Cape Verde, flying start to the tournament, how far do you think they can go?
That's a very good question. I don't necessarily think you can say there's like a set limit on how far they can go. What I would say is it'll be very interesting to see how they do against Egypt. By the time this goes out, that will have happened, because I think that'll give a real gauge of, like, you know, what level that they're at, even though their progress is assured. And there's a chance they may not even take it as seriously as they would have done otherwise. But it would be very interesting to see how they do against Egypt. There are some teams in there that are heating up and you feel will be the front runners. But pretty amazingly, beyond Senegal and Morocco, maybe, it's really beautifully hard to call. And that's as I say, that's, you know, you've got Nigeria and Ivory Coast, both of them battling away to just even get through. And yet both of them were pre-tournament favourites. And Egypt and Ghana, again, pre-tournament favourites. Cameroon, all of them in danger. So it's a fantastic tournament. I think making predictions on AFCON is the easiest way to look stupid.
Before we move on from Cape Verde, one story that we have unearthed about the Cape Verde squad is that of Roberto Lopez. You were the one to initially find out about this. Why was this so interesting for us?
For me, it was very sweeperish because of the way he was recruited. So it's not a surprise that Cape Verde has a lot of diaspora players. As we say, it's a very small population. It's something like under 600,000. But there are Cape Verdean communities and people of heritage all over Europe, certainly. In fact, interestingly, Luxembourg has got a huge Cape Verde population. I remember hearing about that when we're talking about Luxembourg's ascent to success in football, is they've got a pretty strong and passionate Cape Verdean root. But what was specifically interesting about this call-up was how it was done. And I think we're not giving it away, are we, at this point, by saying it was by LinkedIn? Are we allowed to say that at this stage? It was a LinkedIn invitation for a national call-up, which just really tickled me. Because when I get a LinkedIn invitation, it's someone trying to sell me a marketing package for my website that doesn't exist. Whereas this guy got called up to his national football team from LinkedIn.
Yeah, that's right. It is an amazing story. And usually we would talk about it ourselves. But as a special feature on this episode, we're going to hear from Roberto Lopez himself. He's currently in the Ivory Coast with the Cape Verde team in Abidjan. But he's taken some time out to explain to us how he came to play for the national team. So here he is.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking the time to chat to me. So originally, Cape Verde reached out to me on LinkedIn. It was the former manager, Rui Aguas, messaged me on LinkedIn, which I just thought was a spam message because I used to get loads of welcome messages after I connected on LinkedIn. It was in Portuguese, which I didn't speak at the time. So I took no note of it and sort of left it there and went about my business. But thankfully, 9 months later, he messaged me again. This time it was in English. And he was asking if I thought about his proposal. So straight away, I Googled Translate his first message, and they were looking at getting new players into the Cape Verde national side and if I would be interested in it. And I said, yeah, straight away, I'd love to be a part of it. The opportunity was still there. And since then, the ball got sort of rolling. And then a month later, I made my debut against Togo. My Cape Verde heritage is something I've always been aware of, me dad being from the island of San Nicolau in Cape Verde. I grew up knowing about it. I'm traveling there as a young boy, like, but probably never really immersed myself in the culture and the heritage until I got the call up, and the call up has been fantastic. It's really opened my eyes to the world of Africa and Cape Verde, and even further into the world of football, if you will, as well, with the tournaments now that we're playing. the AFCON was definitely probably one of the biggest highlights for me in Cameroon, and now just to do it again, the second one, we got off to a great start against Ghana, like, so these are the memories that will stand out for sure. And there's also the trips where you'll go to countries that I never thought I'd go to, even on holiday, the likes of your Rwandas, your South Africa's, your Eswatini's, and that, like, everything in between, like, it's fantastic, like, to go to these places and see the cultures and see how the people live. It really does humble you and it makes you smile.
Well, Paul, what did you make of that? It's quite an amazing story.
It's fantastic, isn't it? I love how understated he is as well. You know, he just seems such a humble guy. And for this weird trajectory for his life to have taken, as you say, for him suddenly to be exploring these amazing places that he wouldn't have even necessarily thought about, it's fantastic. It reminds me a little bit of the story of Nathan Pond with Montserrat, who had, you know, Montserrat heritage, and just, I think one of his teammates sent an email to their FA. The next thing he knew, he was playing against Cuba. And I love these stories. Again, it shows how bonded the world is and how small the world can be. And it's just a really nice, heartwarming story, I think, for a guy like that to suddenly be a hero for Cape Verde. He'll certainly never be forgotten for that fact he was part of that team that beat Ghana.
It's a good thing that the coach was persistent, right? Because if he just left it at that first message, he might not have ever got to play for Cape Verde. So, yeah, good on the coach for coming back to him. Listeners as well, if you know of any other players who have sort of funny or unique international call-up stories, please do get in touch and tell us. We'll read some of them out on the next podcast. So send us a mail at sweeperpod@gmail.com. Who do you want to talk about next, Paul? Gambia or Tanzania?
Well, I think because it's a similar story in a certain way, I'd love to talk about Tanzania a little bit. So Tanzania have, I think I'm right in saying they have 5 British non-league players in their squad for AFCON. That's interesting. You know, it's not completely unheard of. It's interesting. I have to say, I did a tweet about this and actually it got quite an interesting response. So some people were tweeting back saying how brilliant, you know, it's lovely to see players from Aldershot Town, Telford United, Wealdstone, Boreham Wood, Ilkeston Town, playing at, you know, the biggest tournament in the continent. How fantastic. Other people understandably responded to it, said, what a shame that Tanzania's powers that be don't have enough faith in their homegrown players. So it was a very interesting response. But the player who really caught my eye was Tarin Alarakia, the first Wealdstone FC footballer to play at the AFCON. Who would have thought? What's really interesting about him, again, is he has mixed Indian and East African heritage. So he's also become the first British South Asian to play at the AFCON, which is pretty interesting. So he's from Redbridge in East London. This is a lot of British South Asians live there. He's been at Leighton Orient's Academy, and then he sort of played for various non-league and lower league clubs around Essex, then went to Crawley, eventually ended up at Wealdstone. It's just amazing that then he's playing his international debut against Egypt, and he's up against Mo Salah. It's this amazing sort of counterpoint, you know, where you have this kind of difference of where players have come from in order to play for their nation. It's quite something, really. And it's been very sweet watching sort of Wealdstone's manager, I think he might be their ex-manager, saying, you know, what an amazing achievement and how lovely it is for him. It's something quite heartwarming. So I understand people saying, you know, it's a shame that means Tanzania maybe isn't growing talent in its homegrown league. Fair enough. But I do think there's something lovely about this story.
The thing that really caught my eye about Tanzania was the sacking of their coach midway through the tournament. I don't know if you saw this happen. We'll not see it happen. I presume you weren't in the dressing room, but I don't know if you saw this.
No, I saw that he'd been sacked. I know that he got a massive touchline ban. So this was really interesting to me, wasn't it? That he got in a bit of a spat, didn't he, with Morocco? I think that was, you know, after the Morocco game, there was a big touchline row. And was he not banned for like a lot of matches that would have taken him out of AFCON anyway? So is it that they've put another coach in basically because he wouldn't have been able to coach the team for AFCON anyway now?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what happened. The coaching question, Adel Amrouche, I think he made the comments before the Morocco game, which is quite interesting. He basically said that Morocco had too much sway in African football, that they had influence over the appointment of referees and kickoff times, which, yeah, apparently came shortly before the opening game against Morocco, which they lost 3-0. The CAF then banned him for 8 matches and fined him $10,000. And the Tanzania FA, as you say, Paul, responded by firing him. after the CAF punishment because they knew that they wouldn't have a coach for the rest of the tournament otherwise. And they've named an acting coach whose name is, unbelievably, Hemed Morocco.
Didn't know that. That's absolutely fantastic. It'll only get better if Hemed means something really rude. I mean, the best sledging ever, wouldn't it? We really regret the comments of our past coach. Here comes our new coach. Up yours, Morocco. Oh, that's amazing.
I was having a think about other coaches that have got fired mid-tournament, and I could think of one. I'll give you a clue. It was at the 2018 World Cup in Russia.
No, I don't. That doesn't ring a bell. No, you'll have to remind me of that one. I don't remember it.
I think it was sort of on the eve of the tournament rather than midway through, actually. But it was Julen Lopetegui who was fired by Spain because he had agreed to join Real Madrid after the tournament. And he was fired by the now disgraced Luis Rubiales, who we all know is a bit of a fruitcake, right on the eve of that World Cup.
I didn't remember that, but that does ring a bell now. I think there have been a fair few. It's just I'm struggling to call them to mind now, but I think when I was reading about Philippe Troussier, we're talking about his heroics currently, I think he might have been sacked mid-tournament when he was at Qatar, like just after the first game, they just sacked him. But I'm not totally sure. You wouldn't quote me on it. It's an amazing thing to do. I mean, you think about how much that must unsettle a team when you've only got a limited number of days as it is to kind of get yourselves going. It's quite a big statement to make that you'd rather sack your manager than stick with them for another 6 days or whatever it is.
Let's round off the AFCON segment by talking about Gambia, because they had a pretty big scare, didn't they, on the eve of the tournament. They were on a plane from the Gambian capital, Banjul, heading for Yamoussoukro in the Ivory Coast, and it had to turn around within minutes of takeoff due to a lack of oxygen inside the aircraft. This sounds incredibly scary.
Yeah, and I think it's one of these ones where you can't overstate how scary it was. I think reading follow-up reports, it sounds like they were genuinely minutes away from the entire squad dying, basically. There's no way to sugarcoat that. They didn't have enough oxygen in the cab, and I think if they hadn't got down to a certain altitude very quickly, it would have been fatal, which would have been again one of the greatest tragedies in football history. What I find quite interesting on the basis of that, and you know, we'll never know, is the fact that these players must be deeply affected by that. Obviously, they were real underdogs anyway in that group. They got Senegal and Cameroon and Guinea. You know, that's a strong group. They never would have been anything but the underdogs. But the thought that they are having to go out and play, you know, days after that, I don't know. I wonder how much it has affected them. I certainly know if I'd been on that plane, I would not be okay by now. You know, it's not a thing you just shrug off. So, yeah, really do feel for them. And thank God it wasn't worse, but it really must have massively impacted how the players felt about going out and playing the next couple of days, you know.
I think it was such a close call that if they'd stayed in the air for half an hour longer, they would have probably all been dead, according to the reports that I've read online. And the pilot noticed within 9 minutes of takeoff. So obviously he spotted that quickly and then turned them around. The comments from Sadie Janko were, well, really harrowing. He said on Instagram, after traveling 32 hours in total from Saudi Arabia to Gambia with long layovers in Istanbul and Casablanca, we were supposed to fly from Gambia to the Ivory Coast for the AFCON today. As soon as we entered the small plane that was hired to fly us, we noticed the immense heat that left us dripping in sweat. It was assured to us by the crew that the air conditioning would start once we were in the sky. The inhumane heat mixed with the occurring lack of oxygen left many people with strong headaches and extreme dizziness. Furthermore, people started falling deeply asleep within minutes of entering the aircraft.
Oh, I mean, it's absolutely harrowing. And you know, they're obviously... is also a huge question mark over who is responsible for that. Are there questions to be answered by the FA, whoever's organised these flights? There's got to be some degree of negligence involved in that, surely. But just hearing that account, it does make you absolutely shudder. And yeah, I really hope the players are okay. And for one thing, I can't imagine how hard it will be for these players to have to get back on aeroplanes again, you know, and they will have to. Yeah, it really has put the tournament into perspective to some degree for Gambia. They've not massively performed as they would like, but
you know, who's going to judge them for that after that experience, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, at least they did all land safe and sound. So, of course, that's the most important thing. We want to end this segment on a bit of a positive note. So I just want to come back to a tweet that you wrote the other day, Paul. You said it's almost as if the AFCON and the Asian Cup, which is taking place in Qatar at the same time, are trying to outdo each other. We talked a little bit about the Asian Cup on our last bonus podcast. Which one has been captivating you the most so far?
I've got to say, since my tweet, it's all died down a bit. I jinxed it. But I think what it was for me was Jordan's game against South Korea was absolutely fantastic. That was a brilliant game of football. And Jordan very nearly upset South Korea. And then you've got Japan losing to Iraq. It's the unpredictability of these games. You know, the fact Iraq are now top of that group, Group D, and South Korea are very much sort of fighting to get through Group E in the Asian Cup. And these games have just been so competitive across the board and so entertaining. And then at the same time, you know, you'll have games almost clashing with AFCON, where, again, you've got this scope of groups where underdogs are upsetting the giants. Every game seems to have some drama attached to it, whether it's like a on or off the field drama. So, yeah, I've got to say, two tournaments I've massively, massively enjoyed watching. I wish it was easier for people in the UK to watch these games. I say that as someone who's based in the UK. It's not that easy to watch both tournaments. You have to find quite niche subscription sites to sign up for, or you have to watch them via betting websites. And I can't stress enough how little I support betting websites. It's just I do understand that it is the easiest and cheapest way for a lot of people to watch these games, which is sad in my opinion.
I think that will do for part two. But before we take a short break, we'd like to ask a quick favor. Around 2,000 people listen to this podcast on Spotify and a further 2,000 on Apple Podcasts. So far, around 10% of those listeners have kindly left us a review. Thanks so much if you've done so. If you're enjoying the podcast, please do also give us a review out of 5 stars on your podcast platform of choice. It really helps us to bring in more listeners to the show. Time for a quick bit of music, and then we'll be back to round up our remaining stories. Welcome back to the third and final segment of The Sweeper. We're going to kick off this segment in Croatia with the news that Ivan Perisic has signed for his boyhood club Hajduk Split on loan from Tottenham, which is a nice story as it is, but he's joined Paul on wages of €1 per month.
Sounds like what I could earn being a player. I don't fully understand this. So when you say he's joined on €1, so does that mean Hajduk are paying that? But if you're on loan, doesn't the club that own you generally pay a percentage of your wages anyway?
And that's the thing that people online have been saying. They've been saying, well, Hajduk is paying him €1. What are Tottenham paying him? We don't actually know, but the report comes from index.hr, a Croatian site, and they've said it's €1 per month until the end of the season. But there are bonuses that are included. So he earns an amount of money, which is unspecified if Hajduk make it into the European group stages, which they're looking pretty likely to do at the moment because they are top of the Croatian league by about 6 points, I think. So there are other sort of ways for him to earn money, but the main salary is this symbolic figure of €1. And actually, he's not the first player Hajduk have signed on a €1 per month salary, because a little while ago, they signed Nikola Kalinic also for €1 a month. So what I basically thought is that they are the reverse Barcelona.
Yeah, they are, aren't they? I like the idea of them all being on these €1 salaries as well. And then the other players in the squad just looking anxiously. Are we on €1? But yeah, I mean, it's lovely. It's obviously slightly a PR thing, isn't it? Because as you say, like, we don't know what he's actually earning from Spurs. We don't know quite how these bonuses look. But yeah, there's something nice there. He obviously wants to join them. His heart is genuinely in it. So however much people online will love to pull these things apart, I will silence the cynic in me for a moment.
This did what these kind of topics usually do to me. I went down a very big rabbit hole looking for other players with unique contract clauses. And I've got two for you, which are just fantastic. I actually laughed out loud when I read them. So here's the first one. In 1999, Stefan Schwarz signed for Sunderland from Valencia. And because he had publicly expressed his desire to go on one of the first commercial flights to space, Sunderland inserted a no space clause in his contract.
Wow, what a clause. I love that he's also such a... He's not a big enough star to go to space. That's amazing. Oh, I love it.
It actually came about because apparently his agent managed to secure a place on one of the first commercial flights that would go to space. And I think they were worried that his agent would take Schwarz with him. So they wrote that into the contract, which is obviously brilliant. But the second one, I think, made me laugh just as much. This is the striker Giuseppe Reina. He signed for Arminia Bielefeld in 1996, and he spent 3 years there. And he had it written into his contract, stating that the club had to build him a house for every year of his contract. But because the contract did not specify the size or type of house... They presented him with 3 Lego houses, leading to an out-of-court settlement.
Oh, that's incredible. That's absolutely incredible. I would just love to be behind the team building that Lego house. And oh, that's fantastic. I mean, what a stupid clause and what a brilliant response.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it.
I'm just imagining the sort of Arminia Bielefeld management being like, we didn't specify what kind of house. Why don't we just build him a Lego one? Surely he'll be fine with that.
He'd get wind of it because he'd keep standing on bits of Lego in the dressing room. Like, what's all this? Oh, nothing.
Don't know if you can think of any players with unique contract clauses.
I can't think of any like as good as those. No, that's absolutely amazing. I'd love to know what the settlement was as well. What's like somewhere between a Lego house and an actual house? Like maybe
a shed. Yeah. All right. Well, next up in this segment, we've got a story from Cambodia. I'm going to hand this straight over to you because I don't know much about Angkor City at all.
Well, the amazing thing about this story is it links on to our story about Nauru. So you remember when we talked about Nauru having its first ever football team, one of the only islands never to have played a football match? Well, the guy who's crazy enough to sign up to coach that team is called Charlie Pomroy, and he's British coach. But interestingly, right now, his other job is that he coaches a team called Angkor City. And they are a team that he set up himself from scratch. So he is the kind of president. He also turns out to do pretty much every other role at the club. He set up this club because he wanted to develop like young talent in Cambodia, and he was really frustrated with the way that Cambodian football was being run and the lack of opportunities for players. So he set up this club that are in Cambodia's League Two. He has had a bit of a tough time of things, I think it's fair to say, because they've got almost no budget. They kind of have to do everything on a shoestring. They're a real like underdog team, this Angkor City. They had a game against a team at the top of the league, and they requested to cancel it because almost the entire squad was laid out with a virus. So all that was left really was Charlie himself, the coach, and I think they had about 10 players, but none of them were a goalkeeper. They had no coaching staff left. They didn't even have a kit man. The kit man was out as well. So they requested this game get cancelled, which according to the rules of the league, it should have been. And the request was denied. So they had to take on the team who are top of the league without a goalkeeper. They understandably lost. They lost 14-0. What was really heartrending was Charlie, the British coach, sent me a little voice note before the game just saying, I'm sat here in the changing rooms. I've got 10 players. None of them are a goalkeeper. I haven't actually got a kit man, so I've had to wash the kits. And you know what? They're still damp.
Oh, no.
What a heartbreaking situation. But yeah, it's basically a pretty incredible fact that this club can still keep going. They're always the underdogs, always fighting to just keep giving these young players opportunities. So it's really admirable that they took that game on at all. But yeah, what an incredible job to be taking on that and the Nauru national team. He's a pretty exceptional character. And that bears out, in fact, in the fact that he also briefly had a career as a stand-up comedian, which you don't hear of from many coaches. So imagine his sense of humour is probably all that's sort of getting him through it at the moment.
Yeah, at least he knows how to make the players laugh. When you said that his other job, You made that sound like, you know, he's working at a shop in the day and then he's got like a night gig or something. But to be coaching a club in Cambodia and then Nauru, I presume he will not be doing those concurrently.
No, but it was quite funny. He gave an interview and said what he was planning to do, that, you know, he'd do trips to Nauru and then he'd come back and coach his team in Cambodia. And the journalist in the article puts, I Googled it and there is no flight between those two places. And I sort of thought, well, yeah, there's no direct flight. The Cambodia Nauru flight. But I think it is going to be quite a commute. He's going to have to go Cambodia, Brisbane, Brisbane, Nauru. And then deal with the fact there's not even a football pitch in Nauru, and then come back to his current team where it seems like pretty much all the odds are against him all the time. So, yeah, this is a man who does not make life easy for himself, I think it's fair to say.
Talking of football a long way away, our final story for today is about the world's southernmost six-a-side football match. So tell us a little bit about that.
This is a little bit of trivia that comes up sometimes. So the most southerly football match in the world, I believe, has just taken place between British Royal Navy's HMS Protector, so the people who are on that Navy ship. They docked in Rothera on Antarctica and played a match against the local British Antarctic Survey staff. The game apparently ended 3-2 to Rothera, but this is the beauty of football. If you go on the thread where there's these pics just saying, oh, lovely to see this match played in a great spirit. And sure enough, down below, immediately people are saying, yeah, but what was the score? And it's disputed because apparently one of the goals was scored while they only had five players on the pitch. So it should have been 3-3 apparently. But Rothera only had five players on the pitch when that was scored because their goalkeeper was going for a wee. Now, I love it. I mean, the other thing that I have to say, if you look at the photo of the people that have just played the game, it's absolutely amazing. You've got the Rothera kits. They're in these sky blue kits. You've got the HMS Protector kits, the red kit. It's beautiful. They're all in on this pitch that is basically the end of the world. There's nothing there. Some of the players are wearing shorts, and I think a couple of them have got short sleeve T-shirts on, I think, I've been told. And I just think, wow, these are hard players. So if you can do that in Antarctica, then I kind of want you on my six-a-side team.
Sorry, I've got to come back to the goalkeeper going for a wee. Why did he go for a wee during the game?
Okay, if we're going to really drill down into this, what I believe happened, and weirdly, this game doesn't seem to have been covered by a lot of the big outlets like Sky or BBC. What seems to have happened is the game started with the goalkeeper still going for a wee, like hadn't got ready for the game yet, was like getting ready. And then they scored. So that goal was disputed whether it counted or not. I mean, I definitely think they need a second leg on the HMS Protector, like on the boat. That would be a fair second leg, wouldn't it?
I did also see, looking at the pictures, that, as you say, there were two sets of kits and then one random guy in a Newcastle shirt. Did you see that?
Oh, I didn't know it was a Newcastle shirt. I was trying to spot it. It's black and white stripes, but I didn't recognise that sponsor. Oh, that's Newcastle. I'd hoped it was a bit more random than that. I'd have imagined it was the Geordie who was a short sleeve T-shirt, right? But I can't quite see from the picture.
Oh, I'm still laughing at that. I think we're going to have to end the show there. Anything else you want to throw in before we sign off today?
Nah, I mean, where do you go from goalkeeper taking a wee in an Antarctic football game? Where do you go from there? There's nowhere to go.
Absolutely. All right, then. Well, we'll leave it there for today, but we'll have our next podcast out, the Madeira special episode, on Monday, the 29th of January, and then our next bonus podcast out on Wednesday, the 31st of January, and the next regular pod for everyone else on Wednesday, the 7th of February. So we'll catch you for those very soon.